Headline: South Korea's new president calls Pyongyang's weapons programs a threat to global security and calls for the complete denuclearization of the North. Sri Lanka deploys thousands of troops to enforce a nationwide curfew one day after deadly protests over an unprecedented economic crisis. And clashes erupt between police and protesters in a rally against alleged electoral fraud in the Philippines presidential polls. This is News. Thanks for joining us. South Korea's new president wants the neighboring North to be completely denuclearized because its weapons pose a threat to global security. The newly inaugurated president Yoon Suk-yeol says the South is prepared to resolve this threat through dialogue. According to Yoon, Seoul is willing to offer an audacious plan to help boost the economy of North Korea if Pyongyang moves toward nuclear disarmament. Yoon made the remarks during his inauguration speech in Seoul. Tensions are high on the Korean Peninsula, with the North starting a new push to advance its nuclear and missile program. Pyongyang says its weapons act as a deterrent against U.S.-led threats in the region. Sri Lanka imposes a nationwide curfew after seven people are killed in the latest wave of protests over an unprecedented economic crisis gripping the nation. The situation has been volatile in the country for weeks, amid mostly peaceful protests. But violence flared Monday after supporters of Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa were bussed into the capital, Colombo, and attacked protesters with sticks and clubs. Nearly 200 people were wounded. Rajapaksa later resigned, but even that failed to calm the public anger. The military had to rescue him after protesters stormed his official residence overnight, with police firing tear gas and warning shots to push back the crowd. Thousands of troops and police are now deployed in Colombo to enforce the curfew. The protest began several weeks ago over an economic crisis unseen in Sri Lanka since its independence in 1948. Manila has become the scene of confrontations between Filipino police and protesters opposed to the presidential election results. The demonstrators gathered outside of the Election Commission, claiming irregularities in the polls. Initial results showed that the son of the late dictator, Ferdinand Marcos, has won by landslide. With over 95% of the ballots counted, the 64-year-old candidate has garnered almost 30 million votes, more than double that of his nearest rival, Vice President Lenny Robredo. The official results are expected toward the end of this month. 10 candidates have entered the race to succeed President Rodrigo Duterte. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Today marks the first anniversary of Israel's 11-day bloody bombardment of Gaza, which claimed the lives of more than 260 Palestinians, leaving the enclave in ruins. In the following report, we take a closer look at last year's devastating war on the besieged Palestinian territory.
Gaza left in ruins following 11 days of Israeli attacks on the besieged Palestinian territory. Palestinians breathed a sigh of relief from Israeli attacks after a ceasefire came into force on May the 21st. Cities and towns were heavily pounded by Israeli artillery and warplanes, even at night. Horror and panic go on. Some call their loved ones' names. Others rush them to hospital. And many more grieving for their loved ones. This girl is crying as relatives are carrying the body of her 11-year-old brother, Hossein Hamad, to gravesite. This man and his baby are the only survivors of their family of seven. The baby boy, Omar, was pulled alive from under the rubble after an overnight Israeli airstrike hit the Shati refugee camp in the northern Gaza Strip. At the same hospital, 6-year-old Susie was reunited with her father. Susie was rescued after she had been trapped for 7 hours under the ruins of their home. Her mother and 4 siblings lost their lives. The Israeli attacks took a heavy toll on civilians and caused widespread devastation. But life goes on. Fears of a new outbreak of conflict is there too, as tensions simmer from time to time over Israel's continued occupation of Palestinian land.
Let me introduce our guest for this news review. We have Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Edinburgh. Also Barry Grossman, who's an international lawyer and political analyst, who joins us from Bali. Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Mick Napier. When you take a look at what happened last year, what stood out was how the resistance groups, in particular Hamas, was able to penetrate through Israel, its skies, and its so-called Iron Dome system, and fire these rockets that hit various parts of Israel. Is that perhaps a reason why we're not seeing another war being waged by Israel, given the events that have happened in the past few weeks of Israel heavy-handed tactics against Palestinians?
Well, yes. I mean, Israel only respects force, and nothing else enters their calculus. Last year, what was reported in the Western media as communal clashes really was inside 48 Israel, was right-wing gangs attacking in Palestinian communities with great violence. Palestinian families were thrown onto the street in East Jerusalem, evicted from, kicked out of their homes. In the West Bank, shoot to kill became even more widespread. And the Palestinian resistance, although Jerusalem's a little bit far away, responded to the pressure on the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the other atrocities by firing rockets. Over 4,000 rockets they fired. Now, if you think that the Gaza area, which is mainly filled with refugees from earlier waves of ethnic cleansing, is massively surveilled and policed, that the perimeter has Robocop-type automatic guns that fire at anything that moves, this resistance was absolutely astonishing. Absolutely astonishing. Israel killed 243 people. They bombed hospitals. The only COVID testing session facility in Gaza at that time. The desalination plant, sewage, hospitals as well. And just for show, they had the cameras posted on high-rise buildings, which they bombed in order to produce a spectacle of terror. 58,000 Gazans were made homeless during this, and still they resisted. The Palestinian resistance against incredible odds, I mean, never in the history of a colonial struggle has there been such a disparity, such an unevenness in the power of the colonial power, of the colonial state, and mm-hmm. those people who are suffering under it. So yes, the resistance was dramatic. Just a few figures. In Operation Cast Lead back in 2008, for every Israeli killed, the Israelis killed 100 Palestinians. In 2014, for every Israeli who was killed, and it was overwhelmingly soldiers who were killed, Israel killed 30 Palestinians. So the cost is extremely high, but that's standard. I hate to say this from the comfort of my armchair, but that's standard in any anti-colonial struggle, that these are the okay. casualty figures. So yes, the resistance is amazing, and it seems to have given Israel pause for thought.
So Barry Grossman, we want to take a look at the political side of things here. I don't quite see anything happening, or to have happened, whether it's from the American side, whether it's from the Israeli side. We know that this cabinet headed by Naftali Bennett has said, I'm not going to negotiate with the Palestinians. Full stop. The Americans, I think, just came out and condemned the settlement plan they had, but it seems like the normalization of Arab countries with Israel has replaced any type of negotiations, were they to even happen. How do you see that?
Leave the issue of normalization to the side for a moment and simply observe that the position for a very long time forced down the throats of the political establishment throughout the Atlantic world is that the party to this dispute, that is Palestinians and the squatter nation, have to come up with a resolution on their own, and that neither party, certainly not Palestinians, should be encouraged or even permitted to have resort to international law. that this somehow has to happen through what the Americans call negotiation. And in the aftermath of that operation last year, which could easily have happened this year, because certainly the lead up to what happened last year happened again this year in almost in an almost identical way. The position taken in the aftermath of last year's operation, the first thing that President Biden said was that he hoped that this would clear the way for a resolution by the parties or for the advancement of a solution through negotiation. And of course, that's absurd. That's like suggesting that occupied Europe should have resolved its own problems with the Nazis, or that Jews and other people in Nazi concentration camps should have somehow resolved their situation by negotiating with their captors. It's completely absurd. It makes no sense. It can't be reconciled with the position that the United States and other nations take vis-a-vis other problems throughout the world, for example, in the Ukraine right now. So we can just toss that aside. And I don't think that that position has anything to do with the normalization of relations between certain Arab League countries and Israel, although that certainly doesn't help, and that's a horrible betrayal.
Okay, unfortunately, we're just out of time. Thank you so much for that, Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and thank you, Barry Grossman, international lawyer and political analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Welcome back. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah denounces calls for the resistance movement's disarmament. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says the group's opponents want to turn the upcoming parliamentary election into a political war. Addressing a gathering in Beirut, Nasrallah rejected calls by some political actors for Hezbollah to be disarmed. He said those advocating disarmament want to sell the country to the U.S. and leave Lebanon exposed to Israel. The Hezbollah leader said those opposing the movement want Lebanon to forsake its most significant tool that can help the country drill national resources in its territorial waters. Nasrallah said resistance is ready to help the government extract the offshore oil and gas resources, which can easily mitigate the ongoing economic crisis.
You have a resistance, a courageous resistance, a strong resistance, a capable resistance that can tell the enemy, which works day and night on drilling and removing all the natural resources in the disputed areas. We tell the enemy, if you prohibit Lebanon, then we will prohibit you. Yes, we are capable of prohibiting the Israelis from drilling their natural resources. We have the courage, we have the strength, and we have the capabilities. And I assure you, and I guarantee this, not one single company would dare to come to Karish area or anywhere in the disputed area if Hezbollah declared a clear threat and a clear warning in this area.
Nasrallah stressed that those calling for disarming Hezbollah are ignorant of Israeli threats. He cited Israeli massacres in southern Lebanon, including a mass killing in the village of Hula in 1948. Nasrallah said the Lebanese people resorted to resistance, realizing that the government neglected its responsibility to protect them. He said the resistance secured southern Lebanon, brought self-confidence among the people, and defeated the so-called Project of Greater Israel. Nasrallah urged people to vote for the resistance group in the upcoming elections, saying that there is no hope for resolving Lebanon's problems without Hezbollah. The European Parliament has established a committee of inquiry into allegations that an Israeli software has been used by 50 nations to spy on at least 50,000 individuals. EU lawmakers are furious that the European Commission is refusing to set up its own investigation. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Israel has sold its Pegasus software to dozens of countries around the world, which allows spies to easily hack into mobile phones and retrieve personal data. Apparently, very high-profile individuals have been targeted. Now, the PEGA committee inside the European Parliament has been set up to investigate.
We cannot overemphasize the severity of this scandal. When this kind of spyware is used against innocent citizens, whether they're journalists, activists, lawyers, businessmen or politicians, and regardless where in the European Union or even beyond.
The European Commission has been slated for refusing to take action against Tel Aviv for failing to rein in Israel's NSO company, which produces Pegasus.
This is about the accountability of the European Commission to the European citizens and to the European Parliament. You have a duty to investigate.
EU Commissioner Johannes Hahn told lawmakers it's a matter for national governments.
Mr. Commissioner, if you say it's member states in charge, would you mind telling me which member state is actually in charge of investigating in this and protecting us?
EU countries Poland and Hungary have been heavily criticised for buying the spyware from Israel. But one lawmaker says the bloc turned a blind eye when it was revealed in 2019 that Germany was spying on its allies.
Do not be a hypocrite. Do not point Poland and Hungary. Point everyone. Because who was in charge of German government? Madame Merkel. You were shaking in front of Merkel. Everyone was silent.
There was even a commissioner saying, oh, haha, I have a very boring life. There's nothing on my phone.
Experts say the it's fine, I have nothing to hide argument doesn't hold water.
At the heart of liberalism is saying exactly the contrary. You always need to hide and to have an umbrella against the eye of the state.
The European Parliament's PEGA committee is due to conclude its inquiry in 11 months from now. Already there is a great deal of scepticism that the EU will take any action against Israel regardless of the findings. After all, it has always shied away from doing so in the past. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Insight. And welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the current crisis in the global economic and financial system with Russian economist Sergei Glazyev. But first, this brief analysis.
Even before the war in Ukraine and the severe Western sanctions imposed on Russia, the global economic and financial system was entering a period of transition. Changes in the relative economic power of nations, particularly those of rising powers in Asia, began to challenge America's global financial and economic hegemony. In the US itself, more than 20 years of permanent global war in the name of fighting terrorism has financially, politically, and morally corrupted America. The financialization of the U.S. economy destroyed U.S. production and has created one of the greatest wealth gaps in history, with tens of millions of Americans living in poverty and hunger, and a handful of oligarchs with unfathomable wealth wasting it on personal pet projects. More than ever before in recent history, the United States is weaponizing economic sanctions, the global banking system, and the U.S. dollar itself to wage economic war against whatever country that is not complying with its orders. This, in turn, is destroying the credibility of the very global financial system that the United States imposed on the world following World War II. The severe sanctions imposed on Russia by the West have exacerbated this larger historic transition, because for the first time, the majority of non-Western nations did not comply with Western orders to sanction Russia. And Europe is also suddenly faced with a severe crisis because of its dependency on Russian energy and raw materials. For the first time, there are serious efforts to replace the US dollar as the international trade currency, as well as efforts to create new international financial systems independent of the West. New systems which cannot be abused and weaponized by the West to wage economic war on peoples around the world. It's not yet clear how these new global economic and financial systems will look like, but what is clear is that they will be centered in Asia and will be very different than what existed previously.
Dr. Glazev, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. Doctor, you know, it's interesting because you wrote, prior to the Ukraine conflict, you wrote in your books, in your articles, about particular trends that were already occurring in the global economic and financial situation of the world. Things like weaponization of the dollar, things like using and abusing the banking system, that is the Western banking system that is dominated by the West, for political ends, for punishing countries. A lot of these other issues, which are very many, which we can't all list now in our conversation. And you were at that time already predicting that the current financial system in the world, the current economic banking system in the world, is going to change, and that we're going to be going through a transition. And of course, all of this was accelerated by the Ukrainian conflict and the reaction that the West showed to Russia, the sanctioning, the basically stealing of Russian foreign reserves in foreign banks, something that, of course, we as Iranians are very used to. This is nothing new for us. And we welcome you to the club now. So if you could please explain for our audience in as much detail as possible, what is the current global financial situation dominated by the West that is now coming to an end? Some of the main features of it, some of those main issues as to this current situation, and how is it that we are now transitioning away from this current system and into a new system?
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. I shall try to explain the current situation from the viewpoint of the theory of long-term economic development. I am an expert in this long-term cycles theory, and the present situation is a situation of transition. The world is changing dramatically. It changes both technologically and institutionally. This time, we are going through two transitions. The first transition is technological revolution, the transition to the new technological mode, which means that the economy is suffering from the drastic changes in the technological structure. Each technological structure is the basis for the so-called Kondratiev long wave.
Yes.
These cycles have 50 years length, and every 50 years we have approximately technological revolution. This period is a period of depression in the economy, because the companies, especially in the developed countries, are suffering from the excess of capital in the obsolete industries. Mm-hmm. And it takes time to transfer capital from the obsolete industries to the new one. This transition started about 15 years ago, and now it is coming to the end. The new technological mode, which is based on nanotechnologies, information technologies, digital technologies, biotechnologies, bioengineering technologies, and now is formed, and its expansion is going on the with the accelerated growth. The growth rate of this new technologies is about 35% per year. At the same time, we are going through the institutional change. These changes are taking place in with much more longer periods. The Italian scholar and banker Arrighi studied the so-called long-term cycles, or he called this century cycles, systemic cycles of capital accumulations. And each such cycle is based on the specific institutional structure. For instance, during the last two centuries, we have seen the changes from the colonial type of economy, which was based on the huge world powers in Europe, British Empire, colonial empire, French Empire, Russian Empire, and so forth. Those colonial period of capital accumulation is more or less good explanations given by Marx. Mm-hmm. He showed in his papers that the main feature of this kind of economic structure is antagonistic conflict between labor and capital. This colonial period was characterized by the slave trade, by the exploitation of all over the world by the European empires, and there were no any social rights, no trade unions, nothing which could protect workers from the exploitations from the capitalists. This colonial type structure collapsed in the beginning of the 20th century. The First World War and the Second World War were provoked by the British in order to maintain the British Empire as a leader of the world. The point is that this transition period from one cycle to the another cycle usually is going on through the world wars, because the ruling elite of the leading countries do not want any changes. And at that time, 100 years ago, we have seen two world wars. Both were provoked and organized by British, and the Second World War also by the Americans, who made a huge investments in militarization on German Empire. And the idea of these two wars designed by the British was to have a conflict between Russia and Germany in order to prevent their development. At the beginning of the 20th century, Germany and Russian Empire together were in very close relations. And they produced more goods and they were more advanced. They had faster growth rates than British Empire. And it was quite clear that Russian and German Empire, together with Austrian Empire and Ottoman Empire, becomes a new center of the world. In order to prevent this formation of the new center of the world, British provoked the First World War, which destroyed all those empires, and Europe was also destroyed, and British maintained their world leadership till the Second World War. But at the same time, we have seen the Russian Socialist Revolution and the emergency of the principally new institutional structure. It was a structure based on the central planning economy, which was very new, and which demonstrated a huge growth rates. The industrialization growth rates of not only of industrial production, but of the whole economy in the Soviet Russia was the highest in the world at that time. At the same time, in the United States, another type of this new institutional structure also emerged based on the transnational corporations. From the organizational point of view, the Soviet system and the American system were rather similar. The basic unit in organizational structure was large corporation. In the Soviet Union, it was called ministries, which organized production in this or that industries. In the Western world, they were transnational corporations. For the first time in the history, the governments invented the fiat money, which they used in endless scale. Mm-hmm. The government, the central banks, government central banks, started to print money in those quantities which were necessary to finance investments for economic development. For the first time, we have seen that the monetary limits were overcome. There are no any problems for the finance industrialization in the Soviet Union because the state bank printed as much money as were necessary to finance the growth of productions and investments. The only limits were physical resources. At the same time, in the United States, the Federal Reserve emerged, and Federal Reserves also started to print money in those quantities which were necessary for the American government to finance its budget and to stimulate economic growth. These two principally new, but politically opposite systems, they were common in the way of organization of production, but they were opposite in the political sense. In America, we have seen democracy, in Russia, communist totalitarian state. In spite of the political antagonism, those two systems demonstrated very fast growth, especially the Soviet systems, which didn't suffer from the Great Depression. The Great Britain started to lose its hegemony again. And again, they started to provoke the New World War, again, between Russia, between Soviet Union and Germany. Finally, the war finished with the political results, which was very astonishing for the British, because the British lost the empire, in spite of the fact that they were among the winners. They lost empire because the two superpowers emerged, the Soviet Union and United States, which were much more efficient than the British colonial type state.
That's right.
These large-scale corporations and ministries organized production, mass production, in much more efficient way than have been done by the private companies in the British Empire. So British Empire collapsed, and the so-called imperial, as we define it, imperial world order began, dominated by the two superpowers. Now this cycle comes to the end. Mm-hmm. First, we have seen the collapse of the Soviet Union about 30 years ago.
Yes.
Now we are looking for the collapse of the United States. The Soviet Union collapsed because the central planning economy was very rigid, and it didn't satisfy for the needs of the science and technological progress. This was very a bureaucratic system which reject innovations, and finally the Soviet Union began to go and down in technological competition, and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States becomes the only one leader. But this leadership was not forever, because the American system today is based on the creation of the fiat capital, which has no limits. You see, according to the Arrighi studies, each 1th century cycle of the accumulation of capital has two phases. The first phase is material expansion. The new system of management, the new more efficient institutions give opportunity for those countries which use these institutions to become the leaders in the industrial production in the real sector. But after two generations, the leadership in industrial sector transfers to the leadership in the financial sector. And the second half of this century is the financial expansions. Financial expansion of American capital now have such a scale that the efficiency in the real sector simply doesn't matter. During the last 10 years, maybe 12 years, the amount of dollars in the world economy increased about four times. At the same time, we see that in China and in India emerge the new technology, a new economic system, which have much more complicated structure, which combine the central strategic planning with the market competition mechanism. The government control the money circulation through the government, through the state banking system. And at the same time, the private entrepreneurs, the private companies has access to the endless credit facilities, but they get this access only in those spheres which increase the production of the goods which have consumer demand. So this combination of central strategic planning and private markets and companies' competition gives new opportunities for the economic growth. The government creates, the central bank, government central bank creates money. The government controls the circulation of this money. It's due in such a way to avoid the speculations. They give opportunity to the private companies have a long-term credits, maybe half, 0.5 interest rate, even 0.2 interest rates, which are provided by the government banks for those companies which are able to produce more goods and give more opportunities for economic growth. And the government at the same time block the speculations which undermine the economic stability. For this reason, almost all money which are created by the state are going to the real sector. And today we see that monetization of the Chinese economy about two times higher than American economies. Almost the amount of money which were created by the Chinese state bank during the last 12 years increased about three times. But this money was not going to the financial speculations as in the United States. It was going to the production sector. And we see that Chinese corporations like Huawei, let's say, or Xiaomi, or China Construction, or Power Engineering Company, becomes the huge built corporations. They were created, especially in private sector, like Huawei or Xiaomi, they were created just from nothing, from private cooperatives, which are growing up very fast because the government support these companies with the cheap credits. But at the same time, the government control with the use of the money. It's avoid the capital flight. The currency control is very strong. The yuan, RMB, is convertible only for current transactions, for trade, but it is not convertible for the capital transactions. The capital flows are controlled by the government. And all this monetary mechanism is designed in such a way to promote investments. You see, the Chinese, as well as Indian and maybe Iranian financial system has a clear goal to finance, first of all, new investments, to finance the growth of production, which is quite different from the American and Western system, where the money are created for the needs of the financial oligarchs. They print money in huge quantities without taking care where this money are going. The main idea to get cheaper profits. For this reason, they create various derivatives, which in fact are pure speculative instruments. And these financial bubbles concentrate about 80% of the whole money created by the Federal Reserves. And the mechanism which we see at the moment in the West, financial mechanism, is going through the turbulence. It becomes very turbulent. Every 10 years, we have the financial crisis. And there is completely, almost no economic growth. There is no growth of the real income of the population. So American and European economy is in stagnation. At the same time, the Chinese and Indian economies are growing up very fast. So the world economy is switched to the new center in the South East Asia. We see the new world economic center, which dominates now in the world economy by the growth rates. More than 50% of the growth of the world economy is the growth in those Asian countries. This center is much more efficient. It wins economic competition. And the Pax Americana is going to the end, not because Chinese and Indian economies are growing up so fast, not because they were in miserable situation before. They're growing up very fast because they have much more efficient system of management, much more efficient institutional system. So this new type of economic organization combines the central planning for central strategic planning and private entrepreneurs. We call this type of state as integrated, integrative state, or integrated world economic mode. Because the main function of the state is the combination of the interests, the harmonization of the interests of various social groups. The American style system is designed for the needs of the financial oligarchy. Exactly. The American system protects property rights for the large capital, and they don't care about the workers, about the population as a whole. And for this reason, we see the huge social differentiation, which finally go into the political destabilization, which we have seen during the last presidential elections in the United States.
Exactly.
As for the new type of the state in Asia, we see the socialist ideology, we see the huge role of the moral standards. The state is responsible before the people. The main idea of the economic policy is the growth of the incomes and living standards of the population. So this combination of the socialist ideology, of the traditional values, of market mechanism and central strategic planning, government control over the money creation, shows the huge efficiency. And it is no doubt that the last part of the present century will be dominated by the competition between China and India. Unfortunately, cost about 100 million people killed in the two world wars organized by the British Empire. And now the American financial and ruling elite is trying to maintain its leadership, starting the new world war. We call this war hybrid war, because the main front lines in this war are going in the financial sector, in the economic and trade sector, in information technologies, and only the final stage, they use the military power in order to press opposition and in order to finalize the expansion in the financial and economic and information sectors. But this is the real world war, because the idea of this world war, hybrid world war, is from the American side, is to maintain its world hegemony. And they don't care about other countries. Those countries which are not controlled by the United States are going through the culture, through the color revolutions. Exactly. The American Americans are trying to undermine political stability. In those countries which they do not have control, they introduce various methods for chaotization of those countries. They provoke wars between countries. The main idea of them was to provoke the war between Russia and China. Fortunately, it didn't happen. Now the Russia and China have strategic partnership. And because the China is too large now, and American lose the economic competition with China, they're trying now to press Russia, to undermine Russia, to destroy Russia, in order to improve its position in the world by means of controlling the Russia natural resources and to prevent the growth of China. So American plan today has three stages. The first one, to destroy Russia, because, you know, the Russophobia is one of the long-term, have deep roots in Anglo-Saxon geopolitics.
Exactly.
The whole geopolitics theory of the 19th century, designed by the English and Germans, was the some quasi-science how to destroy the Russian Empire. It was the main headache of the Western geopoliticians to find methods how to destroy Russian Empire. And the Ukrainian crisis, the war today in Ukraine, happened according to the recommendations of their geopolitical theory, starting from Bismarck and then following with Brzezinski. They stressed a lot of times that in order to destroy Russia, first of all, you have to get away Ukraine from Russia, because the formula of Brzezinski was that Russia without Ukraine couldn't be the superpower. And all this Russophobia, which was have deep roots in the Anglo-Saxon geopolitics, now played a key role. Why the United States use Russia as the main goal to maintain the world hegemony? And Ukrainian provocation was prepared on the systemic basis during the 20 years, especially the last 8 years. They trying to control Ukraine. As you know, they organized the coup d'etat in Ukraine. The Ukraine during the last 8 years do not have independent government. This territory is totally controlled by the CIA and other American and British organizations. And the first stage for them is of this hybrid war. In fact, hybrid war began with the sanctions against Russia in 2014. And then the second stage was the economic war with China, where the American used the same methods as the British Empire used in the 30s, when British Empire prevented the access of American goods to their empire in order to get more compatible position in comparison with the United States. Now the United States did the same. They launched the trade war with China in order to maintain their markets and in order to limit the growth of China, but they failed in this war.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
پیغمبر اعظم.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
بفرمایید اربعتون من الذنب شر من الذنب.
In the book Tuhaful Uqul, we have a narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam who refers to four of evil actions which are even worse than the sin itself. These four deeds are insistence on doing a sin, belittling a sin, being proud in doing a sin, and finally being happy in committing a sin. One of the above mentioned sins is to be proud with your sin. This feeling is even worse than the sin itself. By being proud with the sin, a person does not consider his or her sin as something indecent. As a result, the person continues doing that sin.
و چهارم امیرالمومنین میفرمایید الاستبشار، آدم گناه بکنه شاد باشه، خوش باشه.
Yet another type of action which is worse than committing the sin is to be happy with your sin. This means that you committed the sin and you must be regretful. However, you are happy and even become happier when remembering it. Therefore, being proud and being happy with a sin is worse than committing the sin, according to Imam Ali alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.